Here we go, episode 11 of Talking Taker. Thank you for joining us yet again on our encyclopedic exploration, digging up the career of the greatest WWF, WWE, professional wrestling superstar and creation of all time. Thank you for coming in yet again for another edition of Dead Man Talking. I am joined here alongside me. It's my tag team partner, Travis White. How you doing, buddy?
I am excellent. I'm excited to talk about this match.
Me too. My name's Alex Dorio. I don't know if I threw that out there, but hopefully you know that by now. Episode number 11. We're into year number 4 of The Undertaker in the WWF. And
it's flown by, man.
It is flown by, yeah.
Flown by when you only have 4 shows a year.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll get through 94 pretty quick in just 3 weeks, but then things will finally start to slow down, spread out a bit as we get into 95 and the in-your-house pay-per-views come into play, and we get into the monthly pay-per-view era. But it's fun because this is our first Royal Rumble show that we're covering. I just realized that, so it'll be interesting. Royal Rumble 1994. Definitely a fun stop on this ride through the Undertaker's career, a unique one, an interesting one. But before we get into that, I wanted to mention something. You know, we're going through not just the Undertaker's career, but really the history of wrestling over the past 27 years, and we're talking too a lot about what it was like to grow up as a fan during these times, because we lived them out. We've been around more or less for the majority of the Undertaker's journey as fans. So, you know, we might have some younger listeners on here who just experienced it on the WWE Network or things like that. But Travis, you mentioned something a couple episodes ago, just, I don't even remember what you were talking about, but, something that I thought it just sparked something in my mind. I missed it when you said it on the show, but you talked about being a kid and being at the grocery store and going over to the magazine section and going through all the wrestling magazines while your mom shopped around in the grocery store. And that is such a time-specific, unique, vivid memory that I relate to as well. Just this, you know, there are still a few wrestling magazines out there. I see them at the drugstore every now and then. It's just funny to see Pro Wrestling Illustrated or I don't even know what else is left. I think that one still publishes a print issue. But yeah, when you were a kid or when we were kids, I remember specifically when mom would go to the grocery store, I would ask if I could go with her because that meant, that meant I could go see all the new wrestling magazines.
Absolutely.
And there were like at least half a dozen of them
You had Pro Wrestling Illustrated, you had WWE Raw magazine at one point, WCW had a magazine, you had WOW, which was World of Wrestling, I remember. That was always a really flashy cover. They had really good, it was more expensive.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, at least those 4 or 5, and yeah, sometimes those other ones too, you know. But oh man, yeah, I loved going. Mom, you going to CVS or Revco back then?
Yeah,
I would go with you. I'd go just walk in the magazine aisle and pick up every one and basically read them all there.
And not only does that not exist, but just this whole notion of, you know, our parents would just leave us in one half of the grocery store or the drugstore by ourselves to just sit there for 20 or 30 minutes. With no supervision or anything, and that, I feel like that just doesn't happen anymore either. Parents just letting their kids just hang out in one section of the store or whatever, just without them. But I did. I would sit there and I wouldn't move for 20 minutes and get to read through all the magazines, and nobody bothered me. And I never, I mean, I was happy as could be getting to read all this kayfabe analysis of the wrestling business. It was great. Good memories.
I remember looking at like PWI 500, you know, when it would come out. I always flipped straight to the straight to that section and see who number one was.
Yep.
And everything. I remember even, like, you know, in middle school when you'd spend a night or I'd spend a night, we, like, our moms would go, like, let's go with her, you know? Like, spend the night at my house, like, I'd go with her, you know? We'd go stand there in the aisle and look, to, you know, that would cover a lot more ground with the two of us together.
True. So. Yeah, we'd get through a lot of stuff.
This is pre-big internet stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So. There's something about holding that magazine in your hand, man, and just seeing getting the ink on your fingers and smelling that magazine, and it was really cool, man.
I mean, and you really did, you discovered stuff. I learned a lot of stuff about wrestling, and yeah, like I said, you know, it was still written with kayfabe in mind, and they're still putting the storylines over as if they're real and everything. But they also would talk about independent stuff in there. Yeah. They would talk about Mexican stuff, Japanese stuff. It wouldn't get as much coverage as the WWE or WCW, but I mean, I learned about ECW really through those magazines.
Just about to say that. That's how I came to know ECW, honestly, at first, was through those magazines.
Yeah, it sounded like the coolest thing ever, and they would show pictures of Raven and Terry Funk with blood pouring off their face, and I'm like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wanted to bring that up because I forgot to, somehow I missed it when you said it last time, but this show that we're talking about today, Royal Rumble 94, I have another pretty era-specific memory when it comes to this show, and that is that I think I said Survivor Series 90. I've seen that show maybe more than any other. This one is probably right there, right up there with it, because I rented this show when it came out, rented it from the video store, and for some reason, my mom made a copy of this tape for me.
Yeah.
She would she broke the broke the rules. I think we're past the statute of limitations on the FBI laws and everything. FBI warning on there, but I guess maybe I didn't get to watch it in time before it had to be back before you got the late fee. So she hooked the two VCRs together and made me a copy of it and burned me a copy of this tape, and so I watched this tape for all the time after then. I was 8 years old or whatever, and I was obsessed with it. So
that's awesome. I was just talking about how we used to dub videos on VCR to someone else this past weekend, so that's funny that you mentioned that. But yeah, that's awesome that your mom did that for you. So you know what, your mom's come up a lot on this podcast.
She has indulged my wrestling fandom in many, many ways.
Yeah, she's an honorary member.
Probably come up
some more. Take Your Nation.
Yeah. I don't know why. She could have pushed me in a lot better directions, but for some reason she went along with it.
No way. If it weren't for her, we wouldn't be here today doing this.
That's true. This show probably really is perfect for that age, 8 to 12 years old. Goofy, it is silly, it is over the top, but man, maybe I'm sure it is a little bit of nostalgia, but I was so entertained going back and watching this. The whole build up, the whole match from beginning to end, I loved every second of this experience of Royal Rumble 94, of this match. What about you?
Oh yeah, I was just before we started recording, I was saying how how so much happens at this pay per view to set up WrestleMania, which I guess you had to because you didn't have anything, you know, except for Raw and Superstars in between. But a big pay per view. But it's just, I watched way more than just the Undertaker match on this. I didn't watch the whole Royal Rumble because I know how it goes, but I watched pretty much every other match on this. So much. One of my favorite promos of all time: Owen Hart kicked your leg out of your leg. That's my favorite things ever. Setting that up, you know, this is setting up the one of the greatest ladder matches, the first official ladder match, I guess, in WWF at the time, you know, sets up Bret and Owen.
Yep.
The main event, you know, the Royal Rumble, sets up, you know, the story of Lex Luger trying to get his title shot back, and, you know, Bret Hart, he and Bret being the first co-winners, and all that stuff. It's just so cool and so nostalgic, you know. Again, I was sucked into most of the pay-per-view, you know, and then, of course, the best part, in my opinion, is this match.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it's not, like, just from a storytelling standpoint, again, we keep saying this, and this one's not a wrestling, Kurt Angle, you know, wrestling clinic or anything, But the storytelling is perfect.
It
this
is.
Match, in my opinion, and it's just, it's great. And like you said, hokey, cheesy, but in 1994, you know, as a 7 or 8 year old kid, it's right up your alley, man.
This is, of course, where we're getting to Undertaker versus Yokozuna for the WWF Championship in a casket match.
Yes, moved on from the coffin to the casket.
Officially so. In casket match era. We last left off Survivor Series 93 with Undertaker and Yokozuna getting both counted out from the Survivor Series match, All-Americas versus Foreign Fanatics. So Undertaker has challenged Yokozuna to put the title on the line. And we get a glimpse at the build-up before the match, which is really worth watching, maybe even more so than the match. But for just to set the stage a little bit, Jim Cornette, Yokozuna's American spokesperson, and Mr. Fuji try to sneak something into the contract that says the Undertaker, this will be the only title shot he ever gets against Yokozuna, which is the same thing they did with Lex Luger back at SummerSlam 93. But Undertaker one-ups them by Paul Bearer slipping into the contract when it gets mailed back to Jim Cornette or whatever, that this is, they accept that this will be the only title shot he gets, but this will also be a casket match. Right. And wouldn't you know it, Yokozuna happens to have a fear of caskets.
Don't say that word.
What word? Casket?
Don't say, stand, wait, Yoko, it's okay, Yokozuna. Calm down. Do not say that word.
Yeah, what are the odds of that?
We
talked about that in the Kamala match, you know, all these big, there's something about big fat wrestlers, you know?
They hate caskets.
Caskets, they're afraid. Casket phobia, you know, coffin phobia, I'm not sure. But yeah, what do you know? How convenient. You know, he has a fear of caskets. But, again, it is cool to see, because, again, at Survivor Series, he had that little bit, you know, it whet the audience's appetite. He had that little bit of fear when he couldn't really get the Undertaker down or whatever. And then just to see him actually scared, because at this point, he'd been champion. Was he champ since?
Since King of the Ring.
King of the Ring, yeah.
Yeah.
So he'd been champion for a long time.
Long time.
You know? And, he's pretty much dominated. He's been fearless. So to see him have this chink in his armor is really cool storytelling, you know. And they're going to build on that as they get to the match. But all the promos. I mean, we could pretty much just hit play on the promo.
Yeah.
Before here's so many cool things.
They show Undertaker. He's gone with Paul Bearer. I guess they did one every week.
Yeah.
Undertaker's back in his wood shop building. Yokozuna's casket, step by step, which is just
what a handyman.
I love this idea. Yes,
yeah, he loves it.
He just works night and day.
Do it. He does it himself. It shows him doing iron work. You know, he's heating up the metal and beating it, and he's basically making a stake. You know, he's a whittling wood and stuff. It's a double wide, double deep casket.
Yes, excuse me. Double wide, double deep. They specify that.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
That is burned into my brain, man. Double wide, double deep. I'll never forget that.
I'm Yokozuna with my Undertaker stuff shoe into this double wide, double deep casket and slams a lid shut. There on the inside, inscribed, glowing in the dark, will say...
Rest in peace.
However, I was a little let down because when they actually showed the finished product, there was no rest in peace glowing on the inside.
I guess they couldn't figure out how to do that, but they have the nice plush lining in there.
It's beautiful.
It is. Looks very, very comfortable. And of course, this is all going on from between
November.
Survivor Series and Royal Rumble, so they have 1 week where it's Christmas and they have a wreath on the casket. Then they talk about New Year's resolutions.
Undertaker says ho ho ho. That's awesome. That's amazing.
That is great.
And I made my New Year's resolution, Yokozuna. May you rest in peace. So that's Undertaker's resolution, is that Yoko will rest in peace. So there's just so many puns, man.
Paul Bearer calls it the new 1994 model or vehicle or something.
1994 model of the casket. And then probably the best quote in this whole thing is...
You and that rotting flesh you call an entourage. You've made a big mistake. Yokozuna, I don't make mistakes. I bury them.
So good.
I love that.
And you commented the other day, that should be a t-shirt.
That's a t-shirt right there.
Yeah, a t-shirt. Yeah. He's got so many things, though. The only thing you'll hear Yokozuna is the hounds of hell bang for your soul. Fear not, you shouldn't be afraid. You should be terrified. And that last one he said is when he's standing outside the wood shop. That's when Paul Bearer's in a coach, basically, and he's got the double wide, double deep behind him, and he pulls away, and Undertaker's standing behind him like some kind of David Blaine magic trick. And I remember seeing that when I was younger and just thinking how cool that was. So,
but he left Undertaker behind. He drove off without him.
Yeah.
Left Undertaker the there. So we see all those, and then we see... some of these mind games that Undertaker is also playing with Yokozuna, and he's sending the casket out there to the ring. So it cracked me up when they push the casket out there and Yoko's out there, and like him and Mr. Fuji are talking to each other. Vince is in the ring interviewing them, and he's like,
Mr. Fuji has just given Yokozuna orders to, what's he gonna do? Squash the casket.
He's just aghast that he would even think about doing that. So apparently Yoko thinks he's gonna just jump and destroy the casket, and of course he lifts up the door and Undertaker's in the casket, pops up, and Yokozuna falls flat on his back, rolls out of the ring. It's just, I mean, so perfect. I love every second
it's
of
great.
It yeah
it's great. Like you said, mind games, you know, he's playing those mind games, which, and he did with a little bit with Kamala and does it here, and it's going to be one of his things he's going to kind of, you know, be known for, honestly, as his, you know, his as we see his character progress and grow throughout the years. So it was pretty, I'm glad you pointed that out. That's cool.
I mean, what I love about it is I don't think, aside from Survivor Series, which when they were in the match, but from then till Royal Rumble, I don't think they touched each other.
Nope.
And, you know, they were hardly ever even in the ring together. And yet, this whole feud was built up. It had context to it. It had nuance to it. It hyped you up for the match. And they didn't once have to ever physically interact with each other, much less be in a match with each other.
They didn't trade pinfalls back and forth. They didn't have the tag. They didn't have, you know, nowadays you'd be in, you know, tag team matches every week until you get to the actual thing or whatever. But yeah, they were in, even if they, yeah, like you said, they were in the same building, but Undertaker may not have been there. He might have been on a promo backstage, and then Yokozuna's in the ring, you know? And so it was such good storytelling, you know? It really was.
It really was. And all that stuff with managers and contract negotiations and stuff, you just don't see that anymore really either. And I miss storylines like that that made you feel like you're watching like a real sport. And you know, the great thing about the managers throwing in contract clauses and all this sort of stuff is that when the heel loses or the babyface or whatever, it kind of gives them an out, and the manager can take the heat for it, and the wrestler doesn't lose their heat. The manager is the one that gets to go out and make excuses. You don't have the wrestler coming out there making excuses. They still look strong. They don't look like they're out there crying about it. The manager is able to take the heat off of them. And we get that with Heyman nowadays, but it's the exception instead of, you know, the common thing.
Yeah.
Like it was back
then. There's nobody else besides Paul Heyman. So, oh, man. But yeah, and you know what? Yokozuna's got two managers.
He does. Double the fun.
He's so big, he needs two managers.
Two great managers.
Oh, yeah. Who come into play during this match.
They do. So let's get to it. Yokozuna comes out with Fuji and Cornette.
First. Yep. Comes out first.
Comes out first.
That's kind of rare.
Cornette looking ridiculous in his tuxedo.
Yeah.
I love it.
Beautiful tuxedo with two sequined rackets on the back. DiBiase's on commentary too here.
Yeah, we should mention commentary. We said goodbye to Bobby Heenan on the commentary team on our last episode, and now we're at the we're gonna hit some unique commentary teams over the next period. But here we get the I think the only time ever on pay per view at least of Vince McMahon and the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase on commentary.
I don't mind if it's not them again next month. It wasn't bad. It just, you know, you really miss Bobby Heenan.
You really do.
Or Jim Ross, even, you know. So anyway.
I thought it was fine. You know,
it was fine.
Kind of forgettable. But I feel like if DiBiase had stuck to it, he probably could have gotten pretty good with it. But for some reason, I don't know if he didn't like it or Vince didn't like him on there. But, yeah, it was he didn't really stick on the commentary beat. Went into managing.
He definitely does his part here as far as, like, he talks about, you know, as the heel, he says it's not fair because Undertaker gets to have his match that he's never lost in, you know. This is the one-time-only matchup they're ever going to have, and talks about it's no pinfall, no count-out submission, or DQ. Really stressing the no DQ, because that will come into play here.
Yes, yes, they do.
In about 7 minutes into the match, so. We said Yoko's out, and then the gong hits, and we keep beating this dead horse, but the crowd just pops huge. So big, such a big pop. And Paul Bearer comes out pushing that double wide, double deep gasket. And the urn resting on top. And honestly, I didn't see Undertaker for a few seconds until finally he popped up behind him, like, walking. They talk about how he's a shadowy figure walking behind him. And Vince says, that is a phenom. Which, I remember him saying that about... who was that? One of our first podcasts we did, Vince said that about
Jimmy
somebody Snuka. Who was wrestling.
Huh? Jimmy Snuka.
Snuka, I think, yeah. But here he calls, you know, Undertaker the Phenom. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've had that said since. So, again, we're building to the Undertaker lore and building this to what we now know as the Undertaker. So I just thought that was notable. So.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. We're seeing that here. And, you know, I feel like this is... this was a pretty big proving ground for both these guys.
Yeah.
You know, Undertaker, he had that little brush in the main event of back in 91, won the title and everything, but then kind of shuffled back down. He was, like we've talked about, he was still a huge star and used in these big roles, but now they're putting him in the top spot for the championship. And two... pretty young guys here. I mean, I don't know how old they were, what their exact ages were, but pretty young guys, and we're moving away from Hogan and Savage and Warrior and that sort of stuff. Even Bret Hart had been around for a long time at that point. But, this is a pretty big proving ground for them.
I remember saying back when we talked about Undertaker winning the title, that at the time he was the youngest champion, and the person that took that accomplishment from him was Yokozuna.
Yeah.
So Yokozuna would have been... I don't know, 26. I haven't looked it up, but probably 26 or something too. So, you know, you're right. They're both young. That's a very good, you know, analysis there because, it's Hulk Hogan is gone, right, at this point.
Yeah, he's not in WCW yet, but he's gone from WWE.
Yeah, so he had his little comeback in 93, but he's gone now, and Ric Flair's been long gone, and, Warrior's not around. So, Randy Savage is...
He's there.
Is he there?
He's in the Royal Rumble.
But he's not doing, you know, well, that's right, he's in the Rumble. He's not doing, you know, too much.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of this, you know, new generation type thing.
Yeah.
You know? So,
and,
cool.
You can tell...
Part of the reason we're doing this podcast, too, is talk about how Undertaker's been there through all of these different eras.
Yeah.
He's been the steady rock in all of it, so.
And you can tell Yoko's young because he's sporting a man bun. He's super hipster. Yeah.
He was a millennial hipster back in 94, ahead of his time.
And,
although, you don't see many hipsters that fast.
I guess so. I was going to name some, but I'll refrain. I think it's kind of crazy that, as the match starts, and they go in high gear, man. Yokozuna... over 500 pounds at this point,
For a shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. But he, out of these 4 years that we've been watching Undertaker, this 500-pound guy is the first person that, like, can go with Undertaker. And, like, they're going, like...
Oh, yeah.
More than Hogan, more than Jake Roberts, Jimmy Snuka, Kamala, Gonzalez, any of these guys. I mean, he is going at his... And they're going... Like, it's this match is a sprint, man. They go at it, and I loved it. I loved it.
They go so fast. I mean, I made a note later on that Yokozuna looks gassed at the end, but I would have been too.
Yeah.
And he's got me by 300-something pounds, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, but you're right. They come out of the gates as fast and, you know, don't really let up, honestly. You know, he has a little breathing room, Yoko does at the end.
Well, but, yeah.
But he looks me. He looks gassed, you know. But, yeah, that's a great point because he really is, the first opponent that, really goes with Undertaker, you know. Mm-hmm. And they just come out, you know, throat thrust and clotheslines. But he doesn't get nudged in the clotheslines until Undertaker does a flying clothesline. Mm-hmm. Probably knocks him down.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was honestly a little surprised that he went down so quickly. But it's getting over the power of the Undertaker, which is kind of the story of this whole match.
Yeah, they've talked about how he was able to kick out of the two bonsai drops or whatever at Survivor Series, but so Yoko was going to have to hit him with 3 or 4 or 5 or something like that to get him into the casket. And sorry if you hear my dog in the background. She gets stir crazy when we do these podcasts, so you might have heard Rosie and some of the other ones, but she's super, super rambunctious right now, so sorry about that.
Oh, and one of my favorite parts is right near the beginning, he knocks Yokozuna down and throat thrust and knocks him out of the ring, and Yokozuna goes out of the ring, and then he runs himself into the ring post. he just walks toward it and bonk, like smacks into it. And it was on purpose. It wasn't like a botch, but I just thought it was funny. It was like he was knocked loopy, you know, and then he just runs himself into it. And I just wrote awesome. And then they have a really cool callback to Survivor Series
where
he hits Taker's head into the stairs. And Taker's unfazed, and he hits Yokozuna's head to the stairs. Commentary catches it. We caught it, you know. And I just thought, I love those little nuances, those little throwbacks to the story, you know, because, again, there's a story being told here, and it's really cool to see that. So
it's a great spot. They go back in the ring, and Taker hits the old school, which was still pretty new school at that point.
Yeah.
Taker shines for a while, and Yoko cuts him off a little bit, and they head outside, and... bring the chair, steel chair into play. Gets a headshot in there.
Oh, uncomfortable to watch in 2017. Ever. Yeah. So, it was. It wasn't like stiff as, you know, a Mick Foley headshot, but it is still, I was just like, oh, man, it makes me hurt to see that. And then Undertaker grabs like the middle school chair, the plastic chair, and hits him with it, too. Yeah. I thought that was cool.
I guess the timekeeper, somebody was out there in that little chair, and they bring that out. That was funny. I wrote this. This is already, we're like 3 minutes in, and it's already more intense than the Rest in Peace match. Like, they've already done more with no DQ in this match than they did in that. And there's still more to come.
Yeah.
Undertaker, or Yoko, gets the salt from the ceremonial salt bucket and tosses that in the eyes and...
And of the Undertaker and the people in the front row.
It's no DQ,
no,
man.
Like it, the Undertaker.
It's no DQ.
Yeah, they sold it, though.
Yeah.
The people in the front row know sold it.
Sure. They're going back and forth. Nonstop action. Crowds chanting USA.
He rolls Undertaker into the casket, puts him in, and before he can close the casket, he grabs Yokozuna's ankle and... hits his comeback here, and he hits about 8 throat shots, like straight in the throat. But then, out of nowhere, Yokozuna is a belly to belly, and I was like, that was awesome to see. So, again, like you said, they don't let up the intensity, you know.
Mm-mm.
They're going, you know, and they don't, it's not a lot of standing around and posing and stuff. So, it was good.
Taker sits up and hits I call it a choke, slip and fall. Like,
slip and slide.
Yeah. tries to do a choke slam, but Yoko just pretty much falls backwards.
Yeah, it's not his fault. So, it was like a literal slip on a banana peel almost. Like,
yeah.
It looked like he just fell. So, but again, not his fault. Yoko's a big guy.
Yeah.
He went for it. And Yokozuna immediately gets up from that, though. So he's getting put over here. He's unstoppable. But then Chokeslam couldn't do the job, but the running DDT gets the job done here. I mean, you'd have thought he DDT'd him on the asphalt. He just lays there. And Paul Bearer raises the urn, and Taker gets up and hits the... Is this the first time he's done the throat slash, too? He did the throat slash right here, like where, you know...
Okay.
Kind of like to do before the... Tombstone.
Yeah, I didn't. I must have been writing my notes. I didn't see him do that.
So. Well, it's a weird camera shot. It's like from behind the casket, so you can't really see it. It's not like a hard camera shot.
Yeah, it might have been the first time.
Yeah.
Then rolls him in the casket, and I don't know if Crush missed his cue or something, because like Undertaker, he doesn't shut the lid.
Right.
Walks outside of the ring and like goes like he's gonna shut the lid from behind,
right?
And waits for Crush to interfere. We saw the foreign Hawaiian Crush, who's
the international from Hawaii.
Yeah, he's evil, and you can tell he's evil because he has a goatee now.
Sure. Yeah.
He's aligned with Fuji and Fuji and Jim Cornette now, and he comes out to rescue Yokozuna and stop Undertaker from closing the casket.
Yeah, they're back in the ring, and it doesn't really last very long because Taker takes him out pretty easily. But then Kabuki comes out.
The Great Kabuki.
The Great Kabuki, and then Tenryu is out there. Who in the since Survivor Series, Mr. Fuji has, you know, contracted them to come to WWF to help them. You know, I guess as protection for Yokozuna or something. They're kind of loosely aligned with him, I believe so.
I think they were, they didn't say it on this, but if I remember it as a kid, I think they were brought in originally for the Royal Rumble, because they're in the Royal Rumble match too, to stop Lex Luger from winning the Royal Rumble, because they didn't want him to win the Royal Rumble. Yeah. And so then they ended up using them too to help Yokozuna. So they're aligned with Mr. Fuji, and they come out, taking them all out.
Doing work on everybody here. Yeah. Bam Bam Bigelow's out next.
Bam Bam comes out next, and it's five against one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Yokozuna's still in the casket, mind you. That DDT was atrocious. So yeah. And then at this point, Mr. Fuji has the urn.
Yeah.
And then, now I was saying that I wrote, unfortunately, it's off camera because I've been putting over their production and how they usually catch everything, but. For some reason, they just missed this spot. You don't see how he got it, but... And in fact, I think Vince says, how did he get that? So I'm sure he was angry that they missed that, because he's watching his monitor. So, but anyway, we don't see it, but then Bear gets his spots in here.
Yes.
Kicks Fuji and hits him in the head with the urn, and then he nails Cornette from behind, so...
The shot of Fuji like cradling the urn with his evil smile is just pure gold. Just so cartoonish.
It reminded me of Vince sticking his eyes over the when he fought Hogan. How cartoony that was at WrestleMania. Sticks his little eyes over and just I got taken to taken back there. It was like a cartoon, like an evil villain, a cartoon.
He raises the urn up, gives the power back to the Undertaker, who keeps fighting back. Bam Bam gets the salt bucket and tries to hit Undertaker but misses. And then Adam Bomb brings out the phase two of the reinforcements along with double freaking J
coming out. Double F J E double R E double T. Comes out. And then Samu and Fatu are out.
The head shrinkers are out. Yokozuna's cousins, I guess.
Yeah, and just, man, how small is Rikishi here, you know?
Can't believe this is the same guy.
He looks like a different guy. He looks like the Usos, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
If the Usos put on 40 pounds, that's what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, yeah, so it's 9-on-1 at this point.
9-on-1? Taker keeps fighting.
Yeah, the story told here, because Bear keeps raising the urn. They keep selling this power of the urn. What's in the urn? It gives him his power. He keeps raising it. He sits up and is fighting all of them. They're really putting over his mystique and his aura here. And the crowd, there's no diminishing returns here. The crowd pops every single time.
They're into it.
It's a comeback. A lot of times you see the same thing over and over again, and the crowd just gets tired. Not here, man. 1994, they are hot for The Undertaker. And now, your boy, Big Daddy Cool,
Big Daddy Cool comes out.
I say your boy because you had that awesome. Was that Halloween outfit?
Yes.
And with the glove and everything? Oh, man.
We'll get to that when we get to Undertaker vs. Diesel. Let's save that
later. But he comes in, and man, I love Diesel.
Yeah.
I love Diesel. I love Kevin Nash.
He puts the heels over the top here, and I guess 10 against 1 was too much for Undertaker. Where are the Undertaker's friends? Like, where is his teammates from Survivor Series? Where are the Steiner brothers? Where's Lex Luger?
I was going to say, I've been putting over the storytelling here, and that was my one drawback.
Yeah.
Like, how do they, where the heck are the Steiners? Where's Lex Luger? You know, where is literally anybody else?
Yes.
Not one face in the back came out to help him. I don't know. I don't remember.
None of the guys that were feuding with any of these other 10 guys? No Tatanka? No, nothing.
So that was my only, that irks me that they didn't really have a, explanation for that. But again, I guess they just wanted, Vince wants to tell the story here of how powerful Undertaker is. And, because he takes all this and gets a little bit of, come back, here. But at this point, he's out. They put him in the casket and he tries to pop out before they shut it and they get a huge pop. And
Wait. Yokozuna steals the urn at one point, hits Undertaker with it, and then takes the lid off, and the green smoke comes pouring out.
Billowing out of it,
which is a really, definitely as a kid, I thought that was a really cool looking special effect. We talked, maybe this Tuesday in Texas, I think, the Undertaker... the urn. Hulk Hogan opened the urn then, and there was just some gray ashes in there, but they've upgraded, or the power source has changed to this green smoke.
Well, he's got solid liquid and gas, different forms of matter in there, I guess,
There you go.
This is the gaseous state. Depends on the temperature outside.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was thinking that the power of the urn is escaping, which perhaps means, he's losing power. And I just wrote that there's no subtlety there. They don't leave anything up. They're going to spell it out for you. So,
And that's how the Undertaker sells it. As soon as that smoke comes out, he's just dead out there. He doesn't move. He lays down and he can't do anything. And then, like you said, everyone jumps on him. Rolls him over to the casket. Bam, bam.
Big moves to him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They hit all their spots.
It reminded me of the Four Post Massacre from Ready to Rumble.
Oh, yes.
Yes. We'll get to that in a little special bonus episode, maybe. No, we won't. I'm kidding, guys. But they just all hit their big moves. It was like the Nexus, to put it to something, more recent.
That is a good comparison.
Yeah, it's really like the Nexus. They're hitting all their big moves on him, and Samu and Fatu are coming off the top rope, and. I think Double J did like an elbow or something, and
he's so out of place here. Guys, head shrinkers, Bam Bam Bigelow, Diesel, then Jeff Jarrett and his tinsel and flashy cut. Like, what?
Yeah.
Why are you out there?
He doesn't fit. So. But yeah, then they roll him in there, and like you said, he's not moving at all. And the crowd, you notice the crowd starts clapping here.
Yeah.
Like you're in a headlock, and they try to get the face back to, give him some
power. Oh, yeah. They're devastated.
The crowd starts doing that, starts clapping, trying to get him to revive, and he doesn't. Did you notice who closes the lid?
Was it Bam Bam?
Yeah. Bam Bam closes the lid.
And he, lays on top of it?
Yeah. He lays on it. They lock it. So.
And then they kind of roll him out. All the heels do, like they're pallbearers at Undertaker's funeral. They all have their hands on the casket.
It was a cool bitch.
Rolling them out. It was cool. The announcers are all serious. Like, this is the end of the Undertaker. Then the gong rings.
To say the very least, we won't be seeing him for quite some time. So right. I'm like, well, how about we telegraph the next 7 months of WWE programming?
Yeah. More subtlety there.
Yeah.
And then the fun begins.
Oh, yes.
The same green smoke that was coming out of the urn starts to pour out of the casket. The gong rings, the lights go out, the fans pop huge, and we get casket vision on the big screen.
Yeah, GoPro. Man had GoPro in there.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah.
Maybe it's called an Ico GoPro. Anyway.
Too much.
We get casket vision. He's FaceTime up to the Titantron. You get to see the Undertaker in there, and he looks like he's dead. And then all of a sudden, the camera, he makes his face look at the camera, and he says, "Be not proud. The spirit of the Undertaker lives within the soul of all mankind." Are you going to add this clip in there?
I think it's better if you just read it.
Okay, I'll start again. "Be not proud. The spirit of the Undertaker lives within the soul of all mankind. The eternal flame of life that cannot be extinguished. The origin of which cannot be explained. The answer lies in the everlasting spirit. Soon all mankind will witness the rebirth of the Undertaker. I will not rest in peace."
Thank you for doing that.
Some pre Bray Wyatt stuff right there.
Yes.
You know? What's he talking about?
None of that means anything, but it sounds really cool.
It does, especially when I'm 7 years old watching this.
Yeah. The audience is just rapt with attention watching him make this big speech. Like you said, they're telegraphing. I mean, we didn't know back then, but
right.
Undertaker is going on his first hibernation period to recharge. I don't really know why. They've probably talked about it on some other podcast, Pritchard's show, and some other interviews. I don't really remember why he's gone from this point until SummerSlam. Maybe just to like heal up some injuries or something.
Yeah, I felt like it's finally just to, you know, to heal up. Vince just gave him time off because he'd just kind of been, you know, been there doing what he was doing for whatever, 3.5 years now. So he just gave him some time off for some nagging injuries.
Yeah.
That's all I could find. So. But man, they do it in a big way. Production.
Yeah. The lights kind of crackle like thunder, lightning. There's a big explosion. The screen turns from the view inside the casket into some weird silhouette type
X-ray.
Deal. X-ray. Yeah, that's right.
I thought you would take a picture and you put it on a negative.
Yes.
It looks like that.
That describes it way better than I did. And then Undertaker begins to raise up out from the top of the screen, and I should say Undertaker in quotation marks, as he, that someone in an Undertaker outfit floats into the heavens.
Do you know who it is?
Out of the screen. Well, the rumors have always been Marty Jannetty, and I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't know either.
I think when they did this episode on Something to Wrestle, I think Pritchard said that wasn't true, but he also doesn't always know what he's talking about either. So,
right.
But that is what I always read forever, was that it was Marty Jannetty. And it's more fun to think that it was, so.
Yes.
Let's just say that it was.
So, yeah, he levitates out of the, you know, out of the back of the Titantron up into the sky. And, again, I usually put them over for all their production, but, man, I couldn't see very well.
It is hard to see.
There was a blinding light, like, behind him. I know what they're trying to go for, but they couldn't get a good camera angle, you know?
Yeah.
I went back and watched it, like, 3 or 4 times, and was just trying to see. But, you know, you get to see him in his silhouette, you know, go up, but you don't really – it's not as good as – even if it did nowadays, it would be beautiful.
It would be perfect.
It'd be awesome. But, you know, it's okay, you know? But maybe they didn't want to give away those Marty Jannetty in there or whomever it was.
Well, they went for it big time. It's over the top. It kind of ends. Paul Bearer comes back to the casket. He retrieves the urn. He's selling it huge and vamping to the crowd, big time. Like you always say, to the top of the building,
holding the urn up. He's almost shaking it to the crowd like Al Snow would head. You know, holding it up to like Al Snow would do the head. You know, he's holding it like that, and the crowd's cheering. And he looks like at the apparition. Vince says, "I didn't know Vince knew what an apparition was." So. Good job. And then DiBiase goes, "This is not natural."
No.
You think?
He is blown away by this.
Yeah. It's just not natural.
Paul rolls the casket away, and I said, this felt like the end of the first part of a movie, like a three-part or a two-part movie or something like that. And as the hero has been defeated, but we know he's going to come back, and his sidekick, like, retreats back to help him, heal him, figure out the next step of their battle plan or whatever.
Very true.
It was cool. And I guess...
Like,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I guess this is... Is this the first time we've really seen like the supernatural superpower aspect of Undertaker, because you know we've seen him sit up and he definitely takes a beating much differently and is able to recover differently, but like this is to another level where we're he's like speaking from beyond the casket and levitating.
Body's supposed to be in a casket, and now it's not.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, he can teleport and but yeah, you're right. He's always been had a mystique around, but this is the first time you really see the supernatural aspect of it. You know,
they're taking the character to a different sort of territory here, which they do in many more different ways over the next couple decades.
3 years. So, yeah, but, you know, this wasn't, it wasn't an in-ring masterpiece. No 5 stars from Dave Meltzer, I'm sure, but good storytelling, man. That's, you know, sometimes that's all, all it needs to be. It's good. It can be let's look at The Rock and Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 18. Not a masterpiece. Great storytelling, though, you know?
Yeah.
This wasn't that, but I'm just saying, the story gets over here. You build, Yokozuna doesn't lose, you know? Yeah, it took 10 guys to beat The Undertaker, you know? He lost his power because the urn was, all the gas was let out of the urn, you know? But then here he goes on to the great unknown. You know, he levitates out of the arena, and, you know, he'll be gone for a little while, but he doesn't look bad in defeat here, you know?
No, man, it took 10 guys to defeat him.
Yeah.
You know, they kept a heck of a pace during the match when they were actually, when it was just, I don't know, did you write the time down or anything like that?
It's 14 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Like total, but honestly, only about 8 minutes of that is them two.
Yeah, I was going to say probably six or seven, something like that.
Yeah, is the 10-on-1 attack.
So. But they go all out for those first few minutes, and then we get into the, you know, there's a lot of criticism. There's a lot of people that don't like this match, that think it's overbooked, over the top. And, I mean, I understand that. Like you said, it's not a not a technical wrestling match by any means. And it is, you know, you compare it to a lot of stuff you might see today. And it's very different, very much over the top, very theatrical. But that is what The Undertaker does best, I feel like, is the theatrical. And in his later years, we'll get to this, you know, we get to see him show off more of the in-ring technical aspects of his work. But, you know, I've got a soft spot for this match, and I'll probably say that a lot more about these older mid-90s Undertaker things, but It's well done. Undertaker and Yoko are both all in it. The crowd is in it. The crowd loves it, which just gives it a great atmosphere. It's worth watching. Absolutely. Even if you're just gonna laugh at it, that's fine. Yeah, it can be comedy if you want, or you can actually see the enjoyability of it too.
Yeah, I forget to mention this in Providence, Rhode Island. Did they even go to Providence, Rhode Island anymore? I don't feel like I heard them go to Rhode Island a long time, but it's January 22nd in Providence, Rhode Island, so in the Civic Center. So, I love watching the crowds in all these matches too.
Oh, there's some fantastic fans.
Goons.
Yes. So. So there you go. Royal Rumble 94, and we will pick back up with
SummerSlam.
This, I think, was a really fun theatrical storytelling. Our next one might be the opposite of that, but I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen SummerSlam 94, so I'm going to give it fresh eyes, give it a fresh chance, and see what's in there. But we'll see. We'll cover the whole build-up to it.
There's a lot of build-up. Even though Undertaker's gone, there's a lot of build-up. Which is going to be fun to reminisce and watch and talk about, too. So.
Yep.
If you were at Royal Rumble 94... Please let us know.
Let us know what you thought of this match, going back with it. Please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening service, be it iTunes or Google Play, YouTube. We should be on Stitcher by the time that this comes out, hopefully. So that's a new one that we're on. You can follow us on Twitter at Talking Taker. You can follow me at Alex Dorio.
And you can like us on Facebook as well, at Talking Taker on Facebook. We just launched our Facebook page this week. So if that's your favorite social media platform, go like us over there. We'll be posting the episodes, clips, photos, YouTube videos, all sorts of stuff over there. We really appreciate it if you like us on Facebook, Talking Taker.
We'd love to connect with you. I'm just trying to put out some questions out there about the matches. We'd love to hear your feedback on them. We'd love for you to, like we said, watch along with us. You know exactly where we're going. So watch the match with us during the week. And I try to put some promos, some of the build-ups. I try to find some interesting stuff on YouTube and put that on the Twitter during the week. Maybe some promos from shows like Superstars or little things you probably forgot about or didn't see. Or I forgot. I try to find some hidden gems on there building up these matches that are pretty fun to watch. So check that out on Twitter if you haven't already. Pray for me, because when this comes out, I'll be the next day I'll be running my first ever full marathon. So, by the time you're listening to this, hopefully I'm still alive and I might need to go into Undertaker hibernation. I don't know.
You may need a 7-month hiatus he's about to take.
So. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. So that's exciting. You got anything else, buddy?
I just wanted to say, ladies and gentlemen, take her easy.